This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Modern medicine is a miraculous thing. For instance, the latest surgical techniques are saving people who likely would have been lost just 50 years ago. But at least one surgical tool dates back to the 1930s, the rib spreader. And yes, it spreads ribs so the doctors can fix what's underneath. And though there have been some minor improvements over the years, it is still a crude and fairly destructive device. Cracked ribs, crushed nerves, and torn ligaments are just some of the possible complications. Enter Hugh Crenshaw and Charles Pell. They're co-founders of the Durham-based medical technology company Fischient. And they've developed a modern rib spreader, one that might spare some pain and suffering. Their device hasn't hit the market yet, but when it does, it could seriously reduce the recovery time for open chest surgeries. Fischient co-founders Hugh Crenshaw and Charles Pell are with us today. Welcome to both of you.
Well, thanks,
Brian. Here.
Appreciate you having us.
So, Hugh, tell us about the old rib spreader. How does it work? What are its limitations?
Oh, goodness. It's just a simple mechanical jack made out of stainless steel. It is inserted between the ribs with two steel blades that push up against the ribs. And the surgeon turns a hand crank that provides mechanical advantage so that they're able to step-by-step crank ribs open. Unfortunately, the mechanism is while very effective for the surgeon, is rather problematic for the patient. And that's what we've been focusing on.
And it's hand cranked. There's not even a motor to, right?
No, there's not. Well, see, that's one of its strengths in many ways, in the sense that the surgeons like the simplicity and the predictability of the device. It is very effective. When we first started talking to surgeons, we asked if their retractor worked, and they all said, yes, it works fine. And we realized we were asking the wrong question.
It works really well to get those ribs apart. On the other hand, there are some real downsides to this thing,
yeah,
Charles.
It's one of the things that sort of stunned us when we got into this is, you know, we're both biomechanists. And so when biomechanists hatch from the egg, you know, while we're still kind of fluffing up our feathers, the first thing you do is measure force, length, and time on something so you can actually describe something mechanically.
Force, length, and time. Those are
force, length, and time. How okay. hard, how far, in how much time. And that allows you to describe what's going on with the tissues. And the crazy thing is we went out to look to find out, well, what are all the numbers that are out there on that for, you know, spreading open a rib cage? And it wasn't out there. There wasn't anything out there. And we've been cracking ribs open, you know, human beings have been cracking ribs open for, what, a century now?
Yeah, minimum.
And to not measure what you're doing is pretty hard. So our extended group is the first group to ever do that. And Fischient has really broken new ground on that. We've discovered that the force to open up a rib cage is almost the weight of the person. It's almost like hanging somebody from the ceiling from your freshly cut ribs, which is not something I want to have happen to me.
So it takes a lot of force. And talk about what happens, because I suppose the reason nobody's looked into this is we're doing a lot of good. I got to get to the heart. All right, the heart is in trouble. I know
exactly
how to fix
right.
the heart. Let's get these bones out of the way and let me get at the heart. And when I survive the surgery, everybody's happy. But we survive how? What happens to the ribs? What's the consequence of this particular mechanism?
Well, the consequences are multifactorial. A lot of things happen. You hit on a few of them. And what happens is the entire rib cage is a remarkably rigid structure. Because it's not just bones, but they're bound together with a lot of tough connective tissue made out of material called collagen. They're bound to your vertebra very firmly. So what happens is when you start pulling them apart, the ribs have a lot of forces placed upon them. All the ligaments have forces placed upon them. Your back has forces placed upon it. Your sternum have forces placed upon them. And as Chuck just said, those are really large forces. They're far beyond anything you'd ordinarily sustain with a rib cage. And so many things break and tear.
All right. So how does the new rib spreader work?
Well, what we did was we looked at the old one and we said, okay, if we were awake, what would be bad about this? You know, where would it hurt? You know, I mean, the customers, as they say, surgeons have perfect customers, we're all asleep. So we looked mechanically at what was going on and where we knew from background in biomechanics where it could be improved. We made a big list, and we went through and got rid of the crushing of the nerves, and we got rid of the concentrating of the force on one part of just the little blade against the ribs. And we went through systematically. And what we do now is the old rib spreader jumps in sort of like going up a stairs. It's like imagine pulling somebody in a chair up the stairs. You jump and there's these big bangs every time you hit a step. What we do is we open just as fast, but smoothly and continuously. And because we're measuring the forces as we open smoothly and continuously, we can actually tell what's going on with the tissues. And there's another thing in there. We have a special sauce piece of software. We actually listen to the tissues when the tissues are indicating that they're going to break, which is something we've run across, we can actually modulate the behavior of the motor. So because we actually have a feedback loop, we're actually paying attention to what's going on, we can do something about it. If you drive your car, any modern car, and you stomp on the brakes like you always do, your car is paying attention to wheel rotation. And somebody clever figured out what the wheel does before the brakes lock up. And the car senses that oncoming pattern and then changes its behavior to avoid the skid. What we've done is like ABS, but for your ribs.
Okay, but you can, I can understand how ABS keeps my brakes from locking. It lets up on the pressure. But how about keeping my tissue from breaking? I mean, I get to the breaking point. How does stopping? It's going to break, isn't it?
Yeah, well, actually, no. That's the curious thing about it. As biomechanics, what we understood is, first off, no one had ever measured the forces. No one had ever studied the biomechanics of thoracic retraction, opening your chest up. And so what we did was start from a very fundamental point, and I want to give due credit to the original conceivers of the idea. Dr. Gil Bloden, who was a surgical fellow at Eastern Carolina University, and Greg Buckner, who was on faculty at North Carolina State University, were curious what would happen with a retractor that reported the force to the surgeon during surgical retraction. And they demonstrated that you could, in fact, decrease the trauma, importantly, the rib fractures while retracting. We licensed the technology from North Carolina State University, so we're a local university spin-out. Sat back and said, as Chuck said, what do you do to try to prevent things from breaking? If you take a twig and start bending it, you'll hear a snap before the twig actually fails. And what's happening is a small fiber inside that twig has just broken. We're doing that with ribs. We're basically effectively listening. And when we hear a small snap, that tells us that something larger is about to go. And we then take just an evasive action by modulating the retraction to prevent that snap from occurring.
So are you essentially giving the body time to adjust to this new position, and
that
by itself can keep it from breaking?
Well, also that. It's interesting. If you go to exercise, a lot of people will stretch to give their body time to accommodate what is about to be large amplitude motion and high speed. If you use the old retractor, the problem is there's no time. There's just these sudden jumps, sudden yanks on the tissue, and that's biomechanically egregious. You really don't want to do that. What we do by doing it continuously is we give the body time to adjust as it's going, because as we like to say, bodies are made out of fibers and goo, and the goo part doesn't like to be stretched fast. And so what happens is if we do it continuously, the body's continuously adjusting. If we detect little tiny fibers beginning to go, that tells us that something big is going to happen. So what we can do then is slow down or stop, do other things to allow the body to accommodate. So in the end, we can make the same hole in the same time as the old retractor, but we can go just as fast, but we don't have to break anything, or we can greatly reduce the damage.
So how did you guys get involved in this stuff in the first place?
Biomechanics?
Biomechanics.
Talk about biomechanics.
We come from different routes. And again, due credit to the original conceivers, because there's a school of comparative biomechanics at Duke University. And comparative biomechanics is not what most people think of as biomechanics. In other words, studying how joints of people, when they walk, work. It's going and taking a look at every animal, every organism out there, plants as well, trying to understand how they mechanically function in their environment. Stephen Vogel and Stephen Wainwright created this interesting program within the school of the Department of Zoology at the time. I came in as a graduate student, having read Steve Vogel's book on a beach in Australia, doing my best not to come back to Durham because I'm a Durham native, and said, there's just no way I'm going to go back to Duke University. But I became convinced that that really was the right thing to do.
He wrote a book on the beach in Australia, or you were on the beach
reading? I read it on the beach in Australia, as far from Durham as I could, and just swearing I'd never go back. But I'm back and actually love it. We stay here. But Chuck came by a different route.
Yeah, I was born a congenital science geek. And although I jammed myself willingly and happily into the world of art, sculpture, filmmaking, painting, I could never get that out of, I've been building everything since I've been a little kid. And I found myself, after doing robotic sculpture, out in California doing robotic dinosaurs. And somewhere along the line, since I have this habit of calling anyone in the world who is an expert at something, just to ask them directly, I ended up talking to Steve Wainwright and Steve Vogel at Duke University. And somewhere in one of these phone calls, Wainwright said, you know, who are you and why are you doing these things? And by the end of the phone call, he'd invited me out. And so I flew out the Duke, and before I know it, I was shaking hands to start a new institute for living design, which we called the Biodesign Studio. That was quite an interesting thing to leap into that. And what happened was that we found that if we build models of working systems, simple models, those simple models instantly exposed our faults or successes in whatever hypothesis. In fact, they're living hypotheses. So basically, I got sucked into it despite myself. And before we knew it, we had a company that did unmanned underwater vehicles. And before we knew that, we spun out another one. You know, and I did my best to retire from all of that. And this guy over here infected me with the interest again. He said, hey, there's this other problem. And I said, no, I don't want to do it. And he started talking, and I started listening. And before I knew it, I started thinking about it, and I was a goner.
And this whole idea that the mechanics inherent in the biological world actually goes back a little farther than that. A researcher at Duke University named Knut Schmidt-Nielsen, right?
Yeah, well, Knut Schmidt-Nielsen, he was responsible for recruiting Steve Wainwright and Steve Vogel to Duke. But he is one of the most famous physiologists of all time.
Yes.
And if you go to Duke's campus, you'll see a bronze sculpture of a camel, full-size camel, and a man on campus. And what's interesting about this is that the sculpture made by Jonathan Kingdon shows Knut standing on the same ground as the camel. And the question in Knut's mind, in the mind of the sculptor, and talking to Knut about this, is that, tell me about yourself, camel, so that I may know more about myself. And there's no man riding the camel or man dominating the camel. There's a sense of equality there. Knut is responsible for so many things. 2 hours wouldn't be enough time to even begin to list everything we know.
He was a remarkable physiologist, but a classical physiologist in terms of understanding a lot of the chemistry and physics of organisms. He was interested in Steve and Steve because they were interested in
Steve Wainwright. Now.
Steve Wainwright,
yep.
And Steve Vogel, because they were interested in the mechanical side, and it opened up an entirely new discipline. And you know what I want to say is when Chuck and I approach questions now, we approach them very differently. What we do is we take a look at the fundamentals of the mechanics of the system, going to very simple levels. You know, how does that tissue behave? What's it made out of? What would you expect this kind of a fiber structure to behave like? And then the next question for a surgeon is, how would you alter that? How would you deform it and decrease the trauma while you do that?
If you think about it this way, and most people don't know this, 90% of chest surgeries are performed fully open. Most people, and I thought this when we first started, that it was all through little tiny holes and it's all, you know, robotic. And in fact, robotic surgery and video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery and mini thoracotomies and all those little techniques that are minimal holes put together constitute about 10% of chest surgery in the United States. So what this means is that most of them are wide open. And the surgeons are doing incredibly wonderful things. Those women and men do they have talent that I'll never know inside on the heart, but nobody pays much attention to getting through the body wall. And it's that first 5 minutes and sometimes less that actually helps you spend a week or so in recovery afterwards. And so we're concentrating on what happens mechanically to the patient in those first 5 minutes. And can we do anything about that to reduce that damage, and that's what we think we've got a hold of here.
We say robotic surgery now accounts for only 10% of all the...
A fraction of 10%.
Well, but are surgeons moving more and more toward that? In other words, does that mean we may not need any rib spreaders?
To varying degrees. And what I would say is, first off, to answer your last question, we're going to need them for a long time. Surgeons are definitely trying to become less invasive, going through smaller holes. But the chest is an interesting anatomical structure. It creates problems for gaining access, even with small holes, because the ribs stop you from moving the tool around. But also the anatomy inside the chest is very complex. And when a surgeon has to, for example, replace a valve in a heart, it's a remarkably intricate surgery. And as Chuck said, the skills to do that are just amazing. But it also means the surgeon who trains a particular way has difficulty moving into a less invasive approach because they have to retrain. Furthermore, the surgical team is really a team. Each surgery is an orchestrated event. It's not just people kind of listening to the surgeon and doing things as they're told, they anticipate, they know what's going to happen. And to change all of that to adopt a minimally invasive approach can be remarkably disruptive.
Don't tell surgeons that, because they think people are just waiting to hear what the surgeon has to say. as far as they're concerned, they're there telling everybody what to do. But just between the two of us. Go ahead.
But what we're doing, and you know, what we're doing is we don't take – with our – basically, it's a handheld smart rib spreader. That's the first one. But this technology can spread across the entire surgical tray. What we're realizing is that the surgeons are great and the surgical teams are fantastic, but some of the tools are decades or even centuries old. And so what we're doing is we're questioning the design assumptions of those tools. And if we can give new tools to the surgeons without them having to change how they operate, suddenly, basically, I mean, our idea is that in the morning, they're using the steel they know. And at lunchtime, they get to play with it for 5 or 10 minutes or so and understand what's going on. And then in the afternoon, they've got the new tool. We don't want the surgeon to change. We want the outcome to change. So we're just trying to erase that damage, which is caused by the design assumptions of the old tools.
Kind of interesting that all of this technology was born really of the industrial age, which itself was born of the age of reason. So there was the study of biology, the study of mechanics, and yet the kind of brute force that was used in all of industrial technology seems to not have paid attention to any of that until now.
Well, we have to say this. The first time Hugh showed me a picture of a surgical tray, I actually laughed out loud. I thought he was pulling my leg because I recognize many of those tools from a famous Egyptian tomb carving. This is 119 BC.
Yeah.
And then the shock kind of set in. I realized either the Egyptians were prescient biomechanists or we haven't rethought the assumptions.
Are there other tools out there? Are there other procedures that can use this kind of approach?
The answer is absolutely. Chuck makes a great point. The company's focus isn't just open versus minimally invasive. It's biomechanically appropriate versus biomechanically inappropriate. A lot of the minimally invasive procedures use biomechanically inappropriate tools too. In fact, we're developing two new instruments right now for minimally invasive surgery. We're not talking about those out loud too much, but they – again, start from the fundamentals of biomechanics and allow you to achieve the same outcome, again, without disrupting what the surgeon's doing, to make it very easy for the surgeon to learn how to use it, but achieve a much better outcome.
Are there other areas of research apart from medicine that are also benefiting from biomechanics?
Oh, sure. The field of robotics has forever changed. What we like to say about nature is, and this is, I'm quoting Steve Wainwright here, is that the good designs eat the bad designs. They've been doing it for so long that there are a lot of good designs out there. Not perfect, but more than adequate for what you want. And so if somebody wants to operate in a particular environment, like the surf zone in by the shore or in trees or in a particular environment, there are animals that are already making their living out there. And you don't want to copy everything, but there are some tricks that if you pay attention and you measure it, you can take the part that is the essential minimum and incorporate that into a robot, and people are doing it right and left.
It is kind of interesting, though, that we don't use in industrial – in flight, for instance, we don't try to fly like birds in airplanes.
Thank goodness.
Steve Wainwright once told me about he had a problem that someone came to him with. He wanted to see what nature could tell him about an event that occurs in a fraction of a second where an object is traveling kilometers per second striking another object. And he said, well, do what I can, but nature doesn't do that. There are questions that nature doesn't answer in that way, at least biology. But there's something else that's interesting. If you ask an engineer, you go to her with a problem. Her job is to come up with a solution. The biologist, when you give her challenge, she's got the solution, the animal. She has to figure out what the question was. And that animal is solving a whole bunch of questions at once. And so it really takes somebody to sort that out.
Great to talk with you. Thanks so much. Hugh Crenshaw, Charles Pell are the co-founders of the medical technology company Fishent and inventor of the Kinder Gentler Rib Spreader. You can find out more about them at Fishent.com, and it's spelled P-H-Y-S-C-I-E-N-T, Fishent.com. Up ahead, a tour of Bull City through the eyes of a local teacher turned author. Stay tuned.